It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
So I've mentioned a few times that I really like Coke Zero. So this item got my attention, and it has to do with the bottle caps. Coke is coming up with this plan. Right now it's only in the UK, so I'm not sweating bullets about it, to make it so you can't take the cap off. And there's something nice about taking it off, and you take a swig, and then you screw it back on to keep the fizz. But apparently it's an environmental problem. So according to this plan, Coke, Coke Zero, Diet Coke, Fanta, Sprite, Dr. Pepper should all within about a year have attached caps where the cap comes off, but it doesn't completely detach from the bottle. Now, I can't be overly critical because plastic waste is a major environmental problem, but I like my caps the way they are. So we'll see if this catches on or if it's kind of new Coke territory. Hey, Bill de Blasio is running for office again. He's going to run for Congress. He announced at his home away from home Morning Joe today. You know, he might have a chance of winning that race because part of the district is in Brooklyn and he's from Brooklyn. But man, what is it with this guy? I mean, it's pretty remarkable achievement that he won 2 terms of mayor in New York City. He was quite unpopular by the end of his second term. And then he decides, oh, I'll run for president. So he runs for president. The campaign goes absolutely nowhere. So he drops out. And then he announces he's going to run for governor. This would be to succeed Andrew Cuomo, but he'd have to take on the incumbent Governor Kathy Hochul. And then that doesn't work out and he drops out. Now he's going to run for Congress. Does he really not want to get a regular job? Does he not want to spend more time with his family? It's really quite something the way people, some people I should say, become addicted to political life. All right, story number one. The Elon Musk situation has taken a bit of a dark turn. You know, I have a lot of fun with the Elon episodes that we do just about every day. But now, here's the backstory. You know, the other day, Musk said he's always favored the Democrats as the kindest party, but it's been taken over by extremists. But now, for the first time, he's going to vote Republican. And when he made that announcement on Twitter and on some podcast, he predicted, and this is just a few days ago, watch out for the Dirty Tricks campaign against me. Gee, the Dirty Tricks campaign against me. And then as if on cue. So suddenly, a woman who was a flight attendant for the corporate jet fleet at SpaceX has resurfaced, or at least her allegation has resurfaced, against Elon Musk. It just so happens to have been only a couple days after his prediction that a Dirty Tricks campaign would be mounted against him. Now, this is not to take away from the reporting by Business Insider, but I just don't believe that this is a coincidence. And neither does Musk. Here's what he says. If I were inclined to engage in sexual harassment, this is unlikely to be the first time in my entire 30-year career that it comes to light. He called the story a politically motivated hit piece. He also tweeted, the attacks against me should be viewed through a political lens. This is their standard, despicable playbook. But nothing will deter me from fighting for a good future and your right to free speech. Meaning he says he's not going to let this interfere with his $44 billion bid to take over Twitter. And yet another follow-up tweet, he's going back and forth with various other folks. For the record, these wild accusations are utterly untrue. But I have a challenge to this liar who claims their friend saw me, quote, exposed. Describe just one thing, anything at all, scars, tattoos, that isn't known by the public. She won't be able to do so because it never happened. Distinguishing characteristics, Bill Clinton, that's what it reminds me of. The accusations against him and whether or not somebody could describe his private parts. That was one of the, let's say, low points of the Clinton presidency. But just to show you that Musk hasn't lost his acerbic sense of humor, after all this back and forth, hit piece and describe my package and all that, he says, finally, we get to use Elongate as a scandal name. It's kind of perfect. Elongate. I'll let you cogitate on that for a little while. Okay, so the accusation by the unnamed flight attendant is that in 2016, during a flight, Musk asked her to come to his private room on the plane for a full body massage. The attendant is said to have found Musk completely naked except for a sheet covering the lower half of his body. He is said to have exposed himself to her during the massage, touched her, and urged her to do more in exchange for a horse. Hold on here. Is that how these things are done these days? Yeah, sure. Like, we can have a good time, and I'll give you a horse. Not money, not a nice new Tesla. You can give her a horse. I don't know. It must make sense on some billionaire bro level that I'm not able to fully comprehend. All right. Now, the part that doesn't appear to be in dispute, because neither Musk or SpaceX is denying it, is that this was resolved in court back in 2018 between Musk, SpaceX, and the flight attendant, who entered into a severance agreement. She gives up her job, and she gets, in exchange for $250,000, no mention of a horse, a promise not to sue over the claims. Also included non-disclosure and non-disparagement clauses, barring her from disclosing any information about Musk or his businesses. So obviously the woman making these allegations probably did not want to violate the agreement, and so this was all done through a, quote, friend. Now, you could say on the one hand that, they paid her a lot of money to go away. You know, they didn't want the bad publicity. Obviously Musk is extremely rich. SpaceX is a success. So here, we'll make a deal. If you were offended by whatever did happen, don't talk about it. And here's a chunk of money. On the other hand, you could take, if you don't like Musk, you could take a more dark view of this and say that, you know, he bought her silence. You know, go away, don't tell anybody about this, and here's $250,000. I don't know what the answer is, but I do think it is so striking that this comes after, shortly after, Elon himself predicts a dirty tricks campaign against him. Now, Farhad Manjoo has an interesting column in the New York Times about Musk and Twitter. And actually, it's about both Republicans and Democrats. And, you know, Farhad's a San Francisco liberal, but he kind of gives it to both parties. He says, the left argues that companies like Facebook and Twitter aren't doing enough to root out misinformation, extremism, and hate. The right insists that tech companies are going overboard in their content decisions and suppressing conservative political views. He talks about some state laws in Florida and Texas, but they're kind of capricious in terms of, or arbitrary in terms of how they're carried out. It affects certain threshold of users, 100 million in Florida, 50 million in Texas. Florida even included an exemption for companies that run a theme park, meaning Disney, before things blew up with Disney. And, he brings in the Buffalo shooting suspect, and he basically says, under Republican rules, would platforms have the right to remove or refuse to amplify these ramblings, meaning this crazy stuff that the Buffalo alleged shooter has said and in his manifesto? As bonkers as the great replacement theory is, could Facebook delete posts about it? Or would it have to give equal play as with any other political viewpoint? Then he turns to the Dems. Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz called for revisiting the abolition of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which gives tech companies immunity from what is posted by their users. Donald Trump said we should get rid of Section 230, never was able to make it happen. Here's a liberal Democrat, a former DNC chairwoman, saying this is a good idea. But Manju argues that this actually would create all kinds of problems. First of all, it would have chilling effects, intimidating platforms into pulling down lots of controversial content just to avoid litigation. Also says it may trample on Twitter's or other companies' First Amendment rights. Both sides are advocating the same mechanism for fixing the internet, he writes. They want to give judges, government agencies, and other officials the power to decide what tech companies and their users can do and can't do online. And I think that's a good point. Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
All right, number two, Mitch McConnell calling out the Republicans who voted against the $40 billion aid package for Ukraine that just passed. And this is interesting because there's such bipartisan support for giving this aid to Ukraine, a major chunk of it military aid, that President Biden asked for $33 million, and both houses of Congress ended up upping that request. So when this happened last week, 11 Republican senators voted against the bill. Bill Hagerty, Rand Paul, who actually ended up holding it up for a week, Mike Braun, Marsha Blackburn, Josh Hawley, Cynthia Loomis, John Boozman, Mike Lee, Tommy Tuberville, Mike Crapo, and Roger Marshall. Now, McConnell didn't call them out by name, but he said this: anyone concerned about the cost of supporting a Ukrainian victory should consider the much larger cost should Ukraine lose. As a matter of moral principle, says the Senate Minority Leader, the United States is proud to support a sovereign democracy and self-defense. Innocent Ukrainians have been subjected to wanton cruelty, but aid to Ukraine goes far beyond charity. The future of Americans' security and core strategic will be shaped by the outcome of this fight. Anyone concerned about the cost of supporting Ukraine, and as I said, should consider the much larger cost. And that's really something. Okay, story number three. There's a very warm and sympathetic profile of the new White House press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, in the New York Times, you know, the kind that you wouldn't read when somebody like Sarah Huckabee Sanders takes the job. And, you know, in fairness, Karine Jean-Pierre is, as Jen Psaki noted when she welcomed her at the podium, the first black presidential press secretary and the first openly gay presidential press secretary. But in this rather warm piece is some pretty harrowing information that's all there in a memoir that she wrote 3 years ago, Moving Forward, that anybody could have looked up. So probably should have looked up before this, but I give the Times credit for that. And here it is, and this is all in Karine's own words. She grew up in a strict Catholic household where trauma was not discussed. She writes in the book that she was sexually abused as a child between the ages of 7 and 10 by an older male cousin. Sometimes she hid from him in an attic crawl space. The abuse ended after a female relative sensed the problem and intervened. She harbored another secret. Not a secret today, of course. She was attracted to other women. The prospect of disappointing her conservative parents was so upsetting that she briefly considered becoming a nun. At 16, arguing with her mother, she abruptly confessed that she was a lesbian. Quote, again, this is from Karine's book, "I could see the revulsion on her face. For this, she had sacrificed everything. She and her mother did not speak about her sexuality for years afterward. Parents pushed her to become a doctor, but she didn't score well on the MCAT exam. She convinced that she had failed her parents. My entire world crumbled." Again, this is from her book. One afternoon, Karine Jean-Pierre recounted her memoir. She parked her car inside the family's garage, sealed the doors, and turned on the engine. "Everyone will be happier when I'm gone," she recalled thinking to herself. She doesn't know how long she was unconscious. She was shaken awake by her sister, Edwine, who discovered the running car and garage. Her pants were wet with urine. She later disposed of the soiled clothes in an outdoor bin to avoid detection. To this day, other than her sister, her family has never spoken with her about her suicide attempt. So she's been through a lot. This sounds like it was a pretty serious suicide attempt, and that she is lucky that she was discovered, you know, with the engine running by her sister. So it's very different than the question of how she will do as White House press secretary. The Times piece says, look, you know, she doesn't have the years-long relationships that Jen Psaki had with journalists, which can come in handy when you're the White House press secretary. She's a little more informal in her style rather than just sort of reading the talking points, but we'll see how that develops. You know, it's a very, very, very tough job, even if you've been a Washington insider. But Karine Jean-Pierre worked for Move On. She worked for MSNBC. She was as a commentator. So she's kind of bounced around. And then she worked for the Obama White House. And then it turns out that she was named deputy press secretary when Psaki took the job. And now she has moved up. All right. I guess you could call this the Daily Donald. It seems like we do one of them every day. Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson is claiming that Donald Trump, as president, during the 2020 election, threatened to arrest and execute her for treason. Wouldn't that be up to a court of law? Having to do with the results in Michigan during a White House meeting. This is an NBC interview with the Democratic Secretary of State in Michigan, who's running for re-election. And this was not a firsthand account. She says, quote, even the president himself had called on me to be arrested and tried for treason, potentially executed. It felt surreal, she says, and sad hearing it from someone familiar with what Trump allegedly said about her. She was talking to Cynthia McFadden to hear that the president of the United States, when he loses an election, decides that the way to deal with it is to accuse you of treason. Isn't there some way to arrest her? Cynthia McFadden asked. Jocelyn Benson says we should stop expecting there is a bottom to the lengths that people will go to overturn legitimate election results and seize power in our country. Now, spokesman for Trump denied this, said Trump never said this. I have it on good authority that Secretary Benson knowingly lied throughout her interview with NBC News. By the way, speaking of NBC, Pete Williams, who's been the justice correspondent there for 29 years, I think it is, has announced that he's going to be retiring in a couple of months. I mean, the guy has gotten a lot of scoops, including the fact that Stephen Breyer was stepping down, clearing the way, I guess I should say, for Ketanji Brown Jackson. And he's just always struck me as well-sourced, fair to all sides. I first became familiar with Pete Williams when he was the Pentagon spokesman under Dick Cheney. When Dick Cheney was running the Pentagon, and he was on TV every day during the Gulf War under George H.W. Bush. But he's had a great career. All right, back to Daily Donald. Trump seems to be walking away from Georgia, former Georgia Senator, I should say, David Perdue, who he loved because he's challenging Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, who Trump is utterly and totally disgusted with, the reason being that, as we all know, Governor Kemp, a Republican, wouldn't try to overturn the election results in the state of Georgia. Also, he's mad at Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State in Georgia. So here you have a guy who stood up to Trump, did his job as governor as he saw fit, and his opponent was endorsed by Trump and went nowhere. I mean, the former senator has had a lousy campaign. He's way, way back in the polls. And now Trump seems to be walking away from, well, not formally retracting his endorsement. What's happening is Trump's been kind of not doing any more appearances or phone calls for David Perdue. He knows Perdue is going to lose. Seems to have given up his campaign for dead. according to the piece I'm reading here, said three Republicans who have spoken to Trump. They say Trump is groused about what he believes is a lackluster campaign effort from Perdue. Well, he's not the only one saying that. David Perdue doesn't seem to like campaigning. He's not out there very much. He doesn't seem to like raising money. This is the guy who lost during that Georgia special election, along with the second special election in Georgia, that gave the Democrats that fragile 50-50 majority, meaning Kamala Harris would break the tie. So here's a quote from an unnamed person. I think a lot of Republicans are disappointed. Oh, Perdue put his own money into the campaign. A person close to the former president, speaking on condition of anonymity, says, David either has a bunch of geniuses working for him because he's basically spent no money, or he's run the most flawed campaign in America. He still might be able to force a runoff. But, you know, Trump knows which way the wind is blowing. So a lot of this is about, you know, he endorses over the weekend the guy who's now the GOP nominee for governor in Pennsylvania, David Mastriano, because he sees he's going to win. And Mastriano said, look, I was going to win anyway. And now he walks away from David Perdue because he sees he's going to lose. That's politics, I guess, to a certain extent. But a lot of this is about Trump running up his winning percentage, although I think it would have to be counted as a loss if Perdue, as the whole world expects, does indeed lose to the incumbent Governor Kemp. Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this. All right, story number five. NBC has a long piece about Hunter Biden. And it has to do with the laptop. Remember in 2020, the laptop, it's Russian op, no need to cover it. The New York Post suspended from Twitter. Twitter, you know, later was acknowledged to be a mistake. Anything about this laptop cannot be shared. Well, then, you know, almost a year and a half later, New York Times, Washington Post say, yeah, I guess the laptop is real. Yeah, we've confirmed it. I don't, you know, why did it take so long? Maybe because the election was over? In any event, from 2013 through 2018, Hunter Biden and his company brought in about $11 million through his roles as an attorney and board member with a Ukrainian firm accused of bribery and his work with a Chinese businessman who's now been accused of fraud. I mean, Hunter Biden, you know, associated with some pretty shady characters. So also this is based on NBC analysis of the Hunter hard drive, but also documents released by Republicans on two Senate committees. How about that? They don't show what Hunter Biden did to earn these millions of dollars from the Chinese partners. They do raise questions, according to NBC at least, about national security, business ethics, and potential legal exposure. Now, back in December of 2020, Biden acknowledged in a statement that he was the subject of a federal investigation into his taxes, which is still going on today in Delaware. NBC reported that an ex-business partner had warned Hunter Biden he should amend his tax returns to disclose $400,000 in income from the Ukrainian firm Burisma. You remember that name. Few of these deals ever came to fruition, but they do shed light, according to this report, on how fast he was spending money. Expenditures listed on the hard drive show he spent more than $200,000 a month from 2017 to 2018 on luxury hotel rooms, Porsche payments, dental work, and cash withdrawals. Was that all business? I don't know. You have to have a Porsche in order to do business. Biden has admitted burning through cash to pay for drugs and partying with strangers who routinely stole from him, and he struggled to pay multiple mortgages or keep up with his alimony and child support payments to his ex-wife. He says this in his own autobiography. He says the money from Burisma turned into a major enabler during my steepest skid into addiction and hounded me to spend recklessly, dangerously, destructively, humiliatingly, so I did. These are Hunter Biden's words. Now, in a filing by the ex-wife's lawyer, Hunter Biden's ex-wife said the couple's debts were shocking and overwhelming. They owed $313,000 in back taxes. They had bounced checks to their housekeeper, owed money to doctors and therapists. The filing alleged, and this is, of course, in a divorce case, that Hunter Biden had spent copiously on drugs, strip clubs, prostitutes, and girlfriends while leaving the family no money to pay legitimate bills. Actually, that account is not that far off from what Hunter, in his own autobiography, says he did with the Burisma money and perhaps other money. We later learned that a Hollywood lawyer began advising Biden and arranged to pay off about $2 million that Biden owned the IRS. Well, who is this guy? Why is he doing it? I mean, that's a fair chunk of change, right? But legal experts, NBC says, say that paying off the bill doesn't necessarily relieve Biden of criminal liability or even erase his debt. So I go into this in some detail because I think it's a pretty solid report. And also because with Republicans virtually guaranteed to take over at least one House of Congress in what looks to be a coming Democratic wipeout this November, I mean, there are going to be hearings, committee investigations. You're going to be hearing a lot more about Hunter Biden. Now, some of that is pure partisan politics, but this is the president's son. And maybe by the time of the fall election, or maybe not, the federal probe will be resolved one way or another. Merrick Garland will have to make a decision. Is there enough evidence to charge him? It seems like a classic situation for a special prosecutor. Or is there not enough evidence and you shut the probe down? But there's going to be a lot of other probes on the Hill. And that's the way politics works. You know, the Republicans did it when they controlled Congress, when there were endless investigations of what happened with Hillary Clinton in all sorts of ways, but particularly the killing of U.S. diplomats. And Democrats obviously are using the committee that they control to do this major, major, major investigation into January 6th. And the hearings are supposed to start next month. And I question whether or not this is going to make – I mean, obviously, it's going to get enormous amounts of coverage. The media have been waiting for this. But how much new are we going to learn given the fact that so much of this stuff has come out or been leaked or been made public? Well, that's what happens when you have Democrats controlling the committee. It's politics, folks. Now, at the top of the show – I usually say, hope you have a good weekend and hope you have a chance to watch Media Buzz Sunday morning, 11 Eastern. But I got so wrapped up in Coke and Elon that I didn't get to that. So I'll just do the plug now. We've got Hugh Hewitt, the radio talk show guy and contributing WashPost columnist, who I've been trying to get for a long time. I used to go on his radio show a lot. It's only logistics and time zone stuff that we haven't had him. We're going to talk about all the things you've heard on this podcast over the past few days, the Buffalo shooting coverage and fallout, Elon Musk, the disinformation board, and much more. So hope you'll catch that. Have a great weekend. See you back here Monday with more BuzzMeter.
This is Jimmy Fallon inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.